So hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Sprint Podcast. So we're back again this week with a look at the 2001 Acropolis Rally, among several other topics, which we'll get to in a second. So back with us again this week, as usual, we have the omnipresent Tommy Hayes.
Well, how's it going?
And William Nolan is back with us again this week after some sort of mystery disappearance again last week. We don't know what he's doing, but he's back again this week anyway. So,
yeah, I wish I could talk about it, but I don't remember anything.
Yeah, yeah, you just kind of blacked out for the week, kind of, was it?
Pretty much, yeah. That's what cabin fever will do to you.
Yeah. It's finding it tough.
All joking aside, I actually genuinely was sick on my birthday of all days.
Yeah. That's what you get now for skipping episode 2 as well. You know, it's fucking karma, man. Yeah.
I'm tired now. There's no getting out of this.
Yeah.
But to be fair, Art plays a blinder when he comes in. So I call Art McCarrick the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
I was thinking Solskjaer myself.
that's three of us now that had that exact same thought. Solskjaer in the fucking 99 European Cup final. That's probably one of the last games.
Neil Mellor would be another good one. I would use, but anyway, probably not as fashionable.
It's probably one of the last games of football I actually watched. I was a huge United fan back in the day when I was in my early years. But
didn't go to school the next day because of it, because I couldn't face seeing the United fans.
But Moss, the same thing I'd say was probably the year after was when I really started stretching my legs into rallying and just forgot about football. Like, I was a diehard United man.
It's weird how we all kind of transition. Like, at the time, you're still quite into, like, I couldn't give a flying fuck about football anymore, to be honest.
I watch the odd game. I watch United matches every talking about.
Oh, I couldn't. I don't know. I still have a thing in my head. I'd love to go see a couple of, you know, the big games, like the kind of Milan derby sort of stuff. If possible, just purely just to see what it's like.
I actually got the year I was in Rally Spain, 2010. I got to see Barcelona playing the Nou Camp, which was up to that point just probably the best week of my life. I was like,
that's a pretty class week.
It was an unbelievable week. Yeah. Hanging out with Solberg and all them and getting unbelievable access, going to Barcelona, having a laugh in a football ultra.
It's been all downhill from there, basically.
Absolutely, yeah. The problem is I peaked way too soon.
You peaked in your teenage years, yeah. So.
Yeah. What a disaster.
We all did. We all peaked far too soon. And look at us now. Shriveled up. Has-beens. Anyway, we have a fair bit to get through this week. Again, I'm fucking... Hopefully the edit or lack thereof worked out okay for everyone listening last week. I just didn't have time to sit down and go through it. But again, thanks for the feedback that we're getting. It's all good stuff to hear, and that people are still enjoying it and tuning in and interacting and things like that. So big shout out for all that. There's been a few interesting kind of developments during the week. I suppose, you know, we've kind of talked about Simrace and a fair bit now in the last couple of episodes. And I see that just follow. I wasn't watching it or anything, but just I woke up on, I think, Saturday or Sunday morning and fucking had a Twitter notification. And there was just huge debacle about iRacing because the IndyCar series had kind of taken a pretty serious stab at having a kind of a championship, an online sort of a championship. And they'd got, you know, the professional drivers involved. And I think Lando Norris, the F1 driver, was competing, and he's a fairly accomplished sim racer. And he was basically blown off the track by Simon Pagenaud. There was a bit of debate. There was a couple of guys that kind of agreed to take him out, so it just kind of left a bit of a sour taste. But man, I couldn't believe the reaction on it. It was crazy.
Kyle Larson, the NASCAR racer, was also involved in some controversy online with I think iRacing was the platform they were using for that with the NASCAR version of it, where I think his microphone was left on and he uttered a racial slur, I think he lost his seat with Ganassi over it.
I didn't hear
the thing with the slur, but there was a lot of footage of the, what, I don't know how to pronounce your man's name, Pagano or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You could hear the audio of him of where he got spun out, and then he goes back and says, I'm going to go out and take him out. And that's where I think where the big debate came from, because there are a lot of people saying, look, it happened, nothing you can do.
It's opened a bit of a can of worms, I suppose, because if you look at the contrast between what's happening with the F1 sort of drivers doing kind of online stuff, it's kind of more for a laugh, whereas, you know, there was a serious effort put in the IndyCar side of things.
They've had punditry and everything inside in the studio. I was watching it on either, I don't know, was it on BT Sport or ESPN, but you're right, Mars. They've really, credit to them, they have really put a lot of effort into it.
Yeah, like there was sponsorship behind and everything. So I can see the argument for kind of going, look, this isn't just an online race. This is, like, there's the lads are in their overalls. There's sponsors paying for it. It's a proper event. So in some instances, I'd probably be like, ah, look, get over it. It's a game.
Yeah. Does that make you feel less weird now when you sit in the living room with your full rally suit on playing dirt? Just because the professionals are doing it. Is that your justification for it?
Well, yeah, I also have a second seat set up beside me, so I plant my unfortunate other half in the seat beside me.
Yeah.
And sit there holding a notepad just to get it to free feeding.
Yeah, bet you don't listen to a word she says either.
Not at all.
See,
that's the unfortunate thing about me driving right-hand drive cars, my left ear doesn't work.
Yeah, it's just ballast. But anyway, yeah, there's lots. Like it's just, you know, it just shows how far along racing games and a lot of them could be classed as proper simulations at this stage, as opposed to just a game. Like, you know, as we grew up, it was almost a solitary exercise unless you had friends over and you had just a couple of controllers or whatever.
But, like many things as a teenager.
Hey, family podcast. Apart from the swearing.
Yeah, apart from the swearing.
The swearing might push us over the 18 rating or whatever, but...
Fuck's sake, Tommy, it's a family podcast.
Yeah. I told you I haven't got time to edit this week, God damn it. Come on. Give me a break. But, it's just weird to see how much has progressed, as we talked about last week or the week before, the amount of drivers and, you know, competitors and just spectators that are involved in the dirt rally side of it, and how that might pan out. But it'll be just interesting to monitor. But I just have just kind of from the wider world of motorsport, that was an interesting kind of event there over the weekend. A couple of more things as well, and it's something that we've talked about on the podcast as well. Dirtfish, George Donaldson, and a couple of the other guys, they were talking about the potential future for the sport and the potential for the R5 category to step up to become the premier category with a few tweaks or whatever. And, you know, it's just it's you know, from being something that's been talked about a lot by kind of people involved in the sport, but nothing's ever actually kind of gone, you know, through with it. It kind of looks now as if those people are actually starting to take notice and maybe start to consider it.
Well, look, I suppose that we could be going around like a long playing record on this, but I think we're all of the same opinion that this is, like, you can preach about sustainability in motorsport, and I know, William, you've argued as well that cost effective and motorsport aren't mutually exclusive; they don't stack up against each other, but this is a solution possibly to the health of the sport and viability of it going forward as well, because half a million, £750,000 pound or euro cars are not viable. Whereas, you know, a $300,000 or euro car, at least, you put it this way, if Chris Meek made bits of one of those, you know, it's not to the same financial detriment of a team, you know, if there's a car wrote off. But equally, you know, the cars may be slightly less high tech, less capital having to go into them.
Well, not even high tech, Tommy. It's look at the difference. We talked the 2017 cars. They're £1 million a car. They're €1 million a car. So you take, let's say, the likes of Import. I know they had mass concerns after Lappy lost his car. So, yeah. Like, there's no step down in technology. It's just getting more practical around not having a 5, 6, or 20 grand aero package on the front of your car. So, like, if they took the formula of R5, and I know we all agree on this, if they took the formula of R5 and took the Toyota Turbo from the 90s,
the big daddy one.
But you can laugh, but that's really what I would like to see. Like, really, what was spectacular, why we have such a love for Group A, and, like, we looked at through rose-tinted glasses, maybe a small bit as well, because we were, it's back to our childhood. But the cars bore a resemblance to what the car in the street was. Now, if the cars were the R5 cars with a big 40mm 1989 spec turbo restrictor on them, with pushing 400 brake horsepower, more power than grip, very little aero, spectacular. And the human resource end of things for drivers opens up again. You have, like, if you look at the guys that are in frontline seats right now, look at the guys who aren't. Look at the guys who are sitting there simply because the drives aren't there. Extra manufacturers ready to go with a product ready to compete.
Yeah, like, more drives. What would it, like, you're right there, the more power than grip is kind of the basic want for every motorsport fan in whatever category they might be following, you know. It applies to anything with wheels in an engine, basically. But you're right, it is definitely the way to go. You've got a huge amount of cars already built, even, you know what I mean? If they're sensible about it, which, you know, I wouldn't hold my breath and say the FAA are going to necessarily go the most common sense, but there's a huge amount. The base is there, like, you know what I mean. As you said, you have a huge amount of manufacturers already after building cars. You've got a lot of talented guys driving them already. It could be a great thing for the sport. It could, you know, open things up to something like what the year that we are currently doing this series of the podcast on. But because it wasn't, you know, the writing has been on the wall before this crisis happened, as we kind of said already. So, but
potentially as well, what I would love to see is, you look at, this is probably the last year that it did occur on occasion where you'd see a local privateer in a car that was 99% the same as the works cars creeping into the points. With something like this, now, equally, manufacturers don't want to be showing up either. But at the end of the day, it's their product too. So if for example, you a Tom Cave or a David Bogie or a Keith Cronin pops up to do Rally GB.
They go back in time to do the RAC. Yeah,
they do. Yeah, they go out in a group in a Scott Cosworth. Yeah, and with Tiffany Dell. And but theoretically, they can have the same product. You know, yeah,
that's probably something
without like bankrupting themselves and put themselves in the shop window.
Yeah,
talent really becomes more to the fore than aerodynamics and
the latest map from the factory, yeah. or whatever. Like, we've all seen the stories or heard the stories from Anthony Warren Ball's time with M Sport, and, you know, the laptop guy coming over and suddenly the car feeling like it had about 50 more horsepower because he was in battle.
Manfred Stoll as well.
Now, in saying that, now, the only thing about that is you're never going to get rid of that element of tier one and tier two when you're talking.
Oh yeah,
there's private teams against works teams with the same car. Kind of standardizing the platform isn't going to fix that. That's motorsport. Accept it. I mean, as much as I love Anthony Warrenbaugh's thingy, it's kind of like, well, what do you expect? You're a privateer paying for it.
Yeah, they did kind of ride him, though. You know, he did get a fair. Well, going by what he says, again, it's only his side of the story. We don't know, but, you know, they were strapping fucking brown tyres onto the car, tyres that have probably been left outside in the fucking sun for 6 months outside the Michelin factory or whatever. So, you know, I there probably was. Does it obviously, as I said, two sides that like, but
yeah,
it still didn't sound. Do you know, there was a lot of money put in from his side, and he wasn't a slow pilot. Like, do you know,
that's the thing. You see, he wasn't like, he's not like, he's somebody who could go, Asher, look, you just a young lad who had played behind him.
He was quick enough, though. But yeah, again, we don't know. Like, do you know, if you look at around this era, it was probably the end of it in this era. Like, you had local kind of importer teams running cars and their own championships, and like we'd seen the Corollas go very well in Sweden, and they were ran by TTS. You know, a separate concern to TT, obviously with backing or whatever. But you know, you wouldn't see that now. You wouldn't see. I don't know.
But the sport is poorer for it on both levels.
That is, yeah. Definitely.
Like, look at an example of Latvala, how much work it takes for him to get out in the 2017 car this year. Like, I know Sweden was there, but that was a disaster. But I know things are delayed now. But even if things weren't cancelled or put off, he was talking about trying to get back for Finland. He probably wouldn't get much more than that. Like, yeah.
The talent pool is greater than the amount of seats available, and what you need to secure one of those seats, let alone do a couple of one-off events, it's not sustainable for somebody to be there on talent alone anymore. And so somewhere in the middle, there has to be a happy medium. There has to be.
Well, Tommy, it never was. It's never been that way. You know?
It never has been. But equally, like Morris has alluded to there, though, there were national importer teams who bought cars. Like, you look like a Paolo Andreucci, who still was, I'm not sure, was he planning on doing that this year in Italy, but the last couple of years he had an R5 208. But that was an official Peugeot Sport Italia car, because that's something that was probably within the reach of the national importer to, you know, put money behind. A $750 to $1 million car, world car, isn't.
Yeah.
Like, do you know, there's the argument as well that if you have a really quick local guy being run by, you know, a privateer team or whatever, you know, you with the cost of running stuff and the cost of even entering one rally, like we know ourselves, that it just the cost just kind of seem to grow exponentially when you get to kind of the international level and into the world level. Like, it's just beyond reach of the vast majority of competitors. Like, but you get this quick guy, you put as much money as possible into picking maybe two or three rallies in the season that you know he could be strong on, and the car could be strong on, and you focus on them, put as much effort into you can. You saw like Duval in Germany in 2007, where he finished second, didn't he?
Yeah.
In his era, like with sponsorship from Belgian sponsorship or whatever. Whereas if he had to kind of do that out over the whole season, he mightn't have tipping away in sixth or seventh place or whatever, mightn't have got half the coverage, you know. So, but I don't know. It's fundamentally broken.
But that's the beauty of rallying versus Formula One, and I think that's kind of the point I was trying to make on a previous podcast about rallying is not Formula One and shouldn't try to be that.
It doesn't want to be. None of us want to be.
Yeah, but there was a movement to make things probably a bit more, to have it viewed similarly. But
As I said, just another couple of interesting kind of bits and pieces of news during the week. Carlos Sainz was voted the greatest rally driver of all time, according to the WRC official website's poll. So,
I'm happy with that.
I
know, and like I'd be the first person to stand by numbers and stats and data. Lowe was phenomenal, unbelievable. Probably the same era as Schumacher with Ferrari and F1, where they're probably a fairly unbeatable package at the time. But I saw a very good argument on Twitter, and I think I shared it with some of you before, or maybe last week. I don't know who it was, but Gary Boyd in New Zealand, I know he's a major rally stat nerd and great guy. He had shared some guy's post about why Sainz's numbers were more impressive than Loeb's.
I saw that, yeah.
It's a very good thread, and I actually think it puts a bit of meat behind that argument. And like, if you look at kind of the people who are voting on it as well, like, I mean, there's probably, again, same, like, let's say the same reason we're looking back at the season. There's probably a lot more fondness of that era as opposed to the era when Lowe was there, because it was the majority of his era in WRC was the boring era.
Yeah, I think like it's these kind of greatest driver debates. It's the same with F1 or with any category. It's really, really hard to pick one. Like, you know, people go on with F1, Senna was the greatest. No, Schumacher was the greatest. No, Gilles Villeneuve was the greatest. Like, it's totally kind of subjective. Like, it doesn't.
What's the saying? Opinions are like arseholes. Everyone has one.
Yeah, it's true. But, like, you know, I Sainz is one of the greatest of all time. Like, he was, you know, he was probably past his peak in this season, like, but he was still, as we're seeing, like, in probably the most competitive era the sport had seen, he was still well up there. Like, he came very close even to winning this rally. So,
and his times as well, not just winning events through consistency, his stage times.
Beyond his peak, Sainz was better than some drivers at their peak.
Totally, yeah. And he walked. He was one of the, I suppose, the game changers in the sport. Back, he brought a very, you know, professional and thorough approach to it. Like, he Sainz drove a lot of different machinery as well. Like, Sainz would have cut his teeth. You know, in the mid 80s, he would have been rallying in Renault 5 Maxi Turbos. He
drove an RS200, I think, in the Spanish Gravel Championship.
He did. He would have went into the Group A cars, in the Sierra Cosworth, then obviously into Toyota, Lancia, Subaru, you know, Ford, back to Toyota again, Ford again. You know, he drove for a number of teams, kind of spent three fairly distinct eras within the sport. And was, you know, pretty much at the top of all of them. He should, like, if Wright was right, he should have had a couple of more championships. 98 was obviously, you know, it was nothing short of a tragedy, really, that he lost it. And there was, you know, a couple of years in the early 90s, 91, he was quite close in 94 as well, wasn't it?
2003 as well.
Was he close in 2003?
He went into the final round at Salzburg, and Loeb still was a chance at the championship, but there was an issue. It was a peculiar one. The in-car camera system caused a fire inside in the Citroen, yeah, on Rally GB.
In 03?
Yeah.
I thought he went off into the ditch in 03.
No.
Yeah, sure. I think William was right. I think he went off into...
He ended up nose down in the ditch.
Yeah.
There was something to do with a fire, but to do with a camera. Jeez. I know that sounds as bizarre as...
Yeah, I almost looked it up now. Jeez, that's an unusual one.
We're through the looking glass here, people.
Yeah, which is where the most knowledgeable and informed rally podcast host you could ever hope to find would even know what we're talking about. But
I'm putting money on him ending up nose down the ditch, because... I don't know how many times I've spent watching that O3 coverage of Rally GB.
Yeah.
That does look familiar, all right, but I know that there was some kind of that the camera thing definitely occurred in the same sequence of events, though. There was something going on.
That's an interesting one. Not something you want to happen.
No, not really, no.
But this demonstrates, you know, even towards the tail end of his career, that he was still fighting for championships and stuff. So to have someone with a span that long, you know, and like Loeb, again, not taking anything away from Loeb, he's definitely one of the all-time greats of any motorsport discipline, like in sport in general, let's say. Like, you know, but the level of competition wasn't as strong as Sainz had to put up with during his time, or, you know, even like some Mäkinen or whatever. So I can see why the vote swayed towards Sainz, but it doesn't take anything away. Even, you know, any driver that has even a rally win at world championship level, is a seriously talented
pilot. Like, it's not like it's not belittling Loeb's 9 straight titles. It's just like
how many wins is Loeb have?
Sainz doesn't get the world championship trophy for.
It kind of lost all meaning there for a while, didn't it? It was like. Another win, another championship. You know, it was just relentless.
We're both correct on the Carlos Sainz 03 story. I knew that one, it was a chicken and egg situation. I think apparently the concentration was shot to pieces from the smoke being in the car with the, I think it was a wiring fault with the camera, and it put him off with the smoke that resulted and they went off.
GB was a terribly unlucky event for Sainz, actually, when you think back, and it wasn't so. If you had, you know, 0-3 there, 0-1, he had an incident as well when he was still kind of in the running. He would have been lucky to get it, but he was still there, thereabouts. Obviously, 98, I think 91 as well, probably, and 94, you know, he...
89 as well.
89 as well, Jesus, yeah, he's...
He was battling a penteuricula and broke a drive shaft on the final day. Now, Auricula was really pushing him hard, and I think it was down, the gap was down. But,
yeah, no, he's one of the all-time greats, as I said. The reception he still gets in Spain to this day, like, it just shows he's massively, massively loved over there. Like, and, you know, we said before as well, he had trials for Real Madrid. He was a very accomplished squash player. He's, you know, he's just a one of the kind of all-round kind just of great athletes. Just a hero. But any other developments on your side during the week or anything else?
If you don't mind, guys, I'd just like to take a moment just to remember a friend of mine who unfortunately left us this week. You guys will be aware of him, Andrew Kearney from Clonmel. Andrew would be familiar down through the years for rallying a number of different cars. A lot of cars that I suppose we kind of idolise now looking back, you know, Novas and 106 GTIs, and in latter years he rallied a Ford Fiesta R2. I've spent several years navigating for his brother Gus in an E19, and Andrew, real good guy, really good fun, great sense of humour, hell of a driver. Bit like ourselves, and that really nothing he enjoyed more than talking about rallying. The Novas came through Atkinson's in the UK, and if anyone listening, they might know this as well, that Atkinson's major part of the guys working at Atkinson's was Dave Metcalf. And those of you who know your Novas, Dave Metcalf was like Gio Panizzi in a Nova or a Ragnotti. So he told me stories of him going testing and that. So it's been a tough week, and I suppose I'd like to dedicate our discussion of rallying, because there's not an Andrew enjoyed doing more than talk about rallying, to his memory tonight. And our thoughts are with the Kearney family this week.
Yeah, sorry to hear that. And as you said, Tommy, our condolences to the Kearney family and all his relatives and friends. Bit of a sad time for him, obviously, and with everything else that's going on as well. So,
but as I said, not he enjoyed more than talk about rallying. And I'm sure he'd like us to go and rant away about the Acropolis Rally in 2001.
That's good. Yeah, we could. Yeah,
I mean, there's one thing we can do for him. It's that.
Yeah. It's one thing we're really good at. It's talking absolute rubbish about rally.
And they sponsored a rally close to all our hearts, the Stone Throwers nearby. So look, let's enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Yeah, very good. So just for this week, Art, even though he's not on the podcast this week, he still managed to hook us up with a top sponsor. So Ekostroms came on board there.
Oh, brilliant.
Via Thomas Radstrom, who came back for the Acropolis with Citroen. But so specialists in radio control. So hopefully by the time Freddie Dar delivers those ships he promised us, we'll be able to sit at home and control them remotely on the open seas. As we
have a lot of good stuff by the end of this podcast. You know, I never factored that in.
Yeah,
I'm actually glad I cleaned up the shed, to be honest.
You still got boxes of sunglasses, haven't you?
That's it.
He can't shift them. He regrets kind of pinching all in for himself. But as you say, we have a lot of stuff coming our way if any of it actually turns up. But sure, look, we'll
the meat and cheese is probably on the turn now at this stage.
I know it's all cured, man. It's all that's
is it?
That's a good old shed like that.
Are we supposed to get off Baltra? Is it just merchandise or is it actual products?
Did yeah.
Like I've
what those boiler suits.
Oh, actually, yeah, we're living in it. Like I have a 20 square foot garden now. I need to cut some old Baltrow and sort it out for me.
I'll take the tractor. You can have the free overall. So that came with it. Yeah.
Well, that's fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, talks are ongoing about the Saveri rally sponsor, but I'm sure we'll get to that next week. But anyway, yeah. So we'll get on to the event in hand. So the Acropolis, another classic event on the calendar. One that had been running for an awful long time. Now, this is a real staple of the championship, and kind of even though it was, you know, as rough probably as Cyprus, the stages were a bit quicker. The dust again was a huge factor, and the kind of loose gravel on the roads was going to be a big factor for running orders and tactics and that kind of stuff. But like not a rally. I think that drivers probably were not dreading as much as Cyprus, because as I said, the average speeds were that bit higher. You know, there was actually air coming in around the car, even though the temperatures would have been still really high. But a rough event on cars.
Faster rally as well.
Very quick in spots. Yeah. It's kind of southern kind of Greece, isn't it? The area up around kind of Itaia and Kamina Vorla and those kind of places. I haven't been there, now again.
But you know what I know about this event, Matt, is that it's one of those proper rough and tough rallies that it's, I don't know what it is, maybe I just have this weird obsession with rallies that are just hardship and misery. Do you know what I mean? Where there's actually a bit of a fight. Do you know what I mean? Rather than just going flat out, there's actually a bit of a fight and there's a bit of clever driving to be done.
Yeah, there was probably
like,
two.
Like Carrick Forestry.
Exactly, yeah. Basically, anything that would take attention away from my lack of speed, I'm happy with.
Yeah. There was huge, kind of probably too much focus on tactics in this event, actually, with the running order debacle. Obviously, it's something they still haven't managed to really sort out in full. They might never do. It's just the nature of these kind of stages where you have that the first cars are throwing up literally tons and tons of gravel, like, on the stage. You know, over the course of over many kilometers of stages, you can imagine the amount of gravel that they're displacing. So, you know, McAdam was going to be first on the road. He was in for another day one of just fucking suffering again, like. But
just a kilometer down on those stages.
Yeah, it was big.
Just on the point of road order and road sweeping, I wish they didn't change it. I actually love that bit of tactical play where you're trying to jostle for position at the end of the day to improve the road position on the next day. And it gives, for example, you see Solberg and Mac and Martin. Solberg and Mac and Martin had great runs where it gives younger drivers, less experienced drivers, a chance to get in some fast stage times as well.
I like it.
I love Burns giving out about it at the start of the event about McRae and Cyprus, and then he goes off and does the same thing himself.
Yeah.
But I suppose that there's a bit of sandbagging in it too, though, as well. You guys not really showing their full hand, because the last thing they want is to be leading at the end of the day or at the top of the cars, you know.
I think that adds an extra element into the sport.
It does, definitely, but the problem is, like, you're left with you're not really sure who's really going hard and who isn't. And I suppose, but then again, it leaves it very open into a final day shootout. But I think the problem too.
The other option, like, you have is, you know, if you have a running order in such a way that it favours the championship leader going in, and also the rally leader at the end of each leg, or whatever the case may be, whatever has been suggested these days, like, you end up with one guy or two guys just running away with things and everyone else just floundering around, losing time hand over fist. So I think you're probably right, William, as an equalizer goes, it actually worked out pretty well. I know no one seemed to be too happy with it, but they were, at least it kind of equalized things a bit more over the course of the whole weekend, you know. It depended on the event as well, obviously. Like, you know, if you had a wet gravel event, it was all up in the air again, as we'd seen in Portugal.
Exactly, yeah. But I think it holds that element of rally that makes it stand out from other motorsports, is that level of unpredictability, the change. Like, it's not a racetrack. All you can have in a racetrack is either wet or dry.
We know now the nature of rallies, like, and it was going that way in this era as well, where they just turned into basically flat out sprint events from start to finish. They'd lost a bit of that endurance element that had been present back in the day. You know, even on these kind of rallies, the Acropolis, you know, you can see obviously with the tactics and stuff, but a lot of guys, especially in the last day, they were just going hammer and tongs. Like, you know, there wasn't really much thought for trying to mind the car. Yeah. Obviously, the cars have got stronger at that stage, but well, apart from the futures, but we'll get to that in a minute.
And especially, like, if you look at the event and the air and the drivers, like, coming into it, if you look at, say, the four main lads, but obviously, let's face it, 2001 was all about McRae, Burns, Sainz, and Macklin.
Yeah.
But coming into the event, you had obviously McRae, he had tiered one twice coming into Greece, didn't he?
Yeah, two rallies in a row, yeah.
You had, obviously, Burns was fired up because he was pissed off over Cyprus, and he was visibly pissed off with his interview at the start. And Sainz has won it three times. So you're coming into a bloody rough event with experienced guys who are smart drivers. It was actually, I'd love to have been at the event as well, because like, it was a critical point in the season.
It was a cracking entry as well, though, because like the event's made up of 20 stages, was 387 kilometers long, but they had 110 entries. Now, what I found gasping that was that 34 of them were A8, and 18 of those were works cars, but you had 22 Group N cars. But roughly half the entry on what would be reputed to be one of the rougher gravel rallies, albeit not as rough as Cyprus, was made up of two-wheel drive cars. Even like everything down to a Yaris and a Fiat Cinquecento doing the rally.
Yeah, just some going into it, yeah. And fair play to guys, you know, huge local entry, something you just don't really see anymore. Obviously, you know, the costs are like what's an
entry. We must look into how much the entry fees were back then. Just, you know, to kind of
just to compare it, yeah.
Just to compare it, it'd be worth something doing. I think control of tires and control of fuel, things like that, have probably become a bigger factor too, I think, as well.
Yeah, but I know, like, what was the figure being talked about earlier at the time? It was over $4,000, I think, just the entry fee. Like, so that's nearly six or seven national events there for someone straight off the bat, but just on the entry fee alone, do you know what I mean? So it's a big investment's probably the wrong word, but it's a big expenditure.
They made the point, I think, when they covered the JWRC section of the, what was the price cap on them, 180,000?
The price cap, it was supposed to be 100,000 euros, the cost per car, was that was what they were supposed to be able to be bought for,
this event they talked about it being 180, so it just again proves my point again that there's no such thing as cost.
It was 118 or 180?
80, 80, is it?
Was it?
Yeah, I think on the coverage for that, I've kind of looked at it there a while ago.
Somebody made a boo, but they were doing calculations for the sounds of it.
You know what? It was probably closer to what the actual were, because whatever it looks nice on a marketing poster, or it looks great on an email.
But by the time you got one into the shade with all the spares you needed to do, you know, give a decent run in a season, like, Jesus Christ, who, imagine trying to run a Puma in them sales, like, Demi Ox can't even last a fucking one day tarmac rally over here, and then you're trying to get him around 3 days, the boys must have been fucking melted from trying to get balls and stuff tight in service, misery, like.
One of them finished third, didn't he? Or are we going to find out?
Yeah, sure. Ruin everything there, sure. Turn up fucking
for... It's my job, right? Do you know what I am? What can I call myself? I'm Science's engine in a Corolla for this podcast.
That's true.
I will let you down when you
let us down when we need you most. Okay. So
once again, you've made me look like a real fool in front of real people.
Very good. Thanks a lot, dude. Thank you very much. But anyway, just looking at the entry as well. Citroën were in, trying to get a bit of gravel experience. They had Thomas Radstrom and Philip Bigelski. Bigelski wouldn't be known as probably the best gravel driver of the year, but still, you know, he was a very kind of faithful guy to the Citroën team. And once he got in there, I know he was quite gutted that the initial signs for the WRC project was going to be Canada 99, and he was pretty disgusted about that he wouldn't get the chance to do a full season. He never actually got a full campaign, really. So he didn't. He was
no.
He was
bits and pieces.
Yeah, he was still testing. He was still doing a lot of testing work from all the way up a lab, and you know, even as far as the C4, in Citroen Sport, probably, you know, he was definitely a contributing factor in a lot of their success. So, but yeah, so it's good to see. And you know, the Zara looked kind of, it was a very tarmac oriented car, I suppose. You know, for the initial phase of its development, it looked almost wrong in gravel trim. Maybe just, you know, it looked like it was running higher than other cars and stuff like that. But it didn't take him too long to turn it into a competitive package. But it was just unusual to see at the time. So that was, you know, and obviously you had the full complement of the other WOX teams again. You know, stunning, as you said, 34 AA cars again. Like we're just talking about, if you want to call them R5 plus or whatever. It's not beyond the realms of possibility to imagine an event in the future which if they're sensible with the regs to have 30 plus top level cars in a world championship rally again. We haven't seen that for an awful long time, like not since this era, like so.
Some interesting cars actually made up that 34 AA cars, and there was a few privateers. Hamid El Behaibi, did he burn his car out in the last rally as well, if I remember rightly? Well, if so, he got another S6 for this event. Matthias Kalla was entered in a Seat Cordoba in the private car. Anthony Warmbold, who we mentioned earlier, he was out in Group A, Celica GT4. Gilles Panizzi was entered in Grifone 206. And following his sixth overall in the last rally, Pasi Hagström was back in a Corolla alongside Henrik Lundgaard. On a side note, Henrik Lundgaard, I think his son is racing in F2, or should have been racing in F2 this year. I think he was doing one of the virtual Grand Prix at the weekend. So, and Roman Cresta was out in a Focus. A fairly deep privateer entry there. Simon Jean Joseph as well, out in a 206 X Ford and Subaru WOX driver.
Very good, very good. And like, there was a huge quantity of Super 1600 cars. It was obviously accounting around for the WRC. It was the second round of the championship, wasn't it, after Catalonia. A very, very tough test for cars like that, you know. I can't remember the last time I saw one in the forest, to be honest. You know, you'd see the odd one over here still on tarmac or whatever, and they're obviously still big on the continent. But I haven't seen one on the gravel for an awful long time, so this is probably the roughest event you could try and take one on.
Did any of you see the video of Colin McRae doing, I think he was doing zero care for the McRae Stages rally in the Rapid Fit?
Oh, yeah, it was class.
Super 1600, the Martin Rowe care.
Yeah, that was really good. Really,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
I think wasn't that Rapid Fit car in Colin McRae, was it two?
Three. It was just a kind of a plain silvery blue one in Colin McRae two, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a four wheel drive car in Colin McRae two.
Yeah,
that was like the Liam O'Callaghan car
of the day. That was the Esco Cosworth running gear or something, was it?
It was one of the last projects at Boreham, I believe. No, I'm open to correction on this, but I'd like to think we have somebody listening to this who might be XRED or ex-Boreham who can correct us on this. But yeah. I think that was one of the last of the projects that they conducted at Boreham. Obviously, Malcolm Wilson Motorsport, or what's now in sport, were on the world team at that stage. But that was... Yeah, it was like an Escort Cosworth or a World Care bits in Puma Shell. Marcus Dodd had it on the Manx National Rally in 98, and I think he did Lurgan Park in it, and I think Liam O'Callaghan did Lurgan Park Rally up in Lurgan in the north of Ireland in 99.
Yeah.
Didn't see a lot of it, but very cool machine.
Cool machine. The Pumas are actually a lovely car. You know, there's a couple of racing Pumas there on Cork and stuff. I love seeing them on the road. They're just such a class looking yoke. Good yoke to rust, like any Ford of that era. Great to handle, but mine, they just get ate alive with fucking tin worm. We'll get into the rally itself. As we said already, the key kind of, I suppose, element for the first couple of days was the tactical side, which is trying to sweep that loose gravel. As you said, William, Mackinnon was losing major time running first on the road.
Yeah, I mean, he was the first two stages where he really lost it. And like he was in a good position coming into the rally, because he was obviously, it was only a point, but he was still leading the championship. But I'd say he was really getting to the point of driving the nuts out of the car and just being first on the road and having the car near the end of its life. Yeah, it was just never really going to happen, was it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Just looking at the times, Burns was actually quickest on stage one, just by 0.1 of a second from Salberg, and Granholm was 0.2 of a second behind again. So obviously, raw position sort of favouring those guys further back. Like Mackinnon, as you said, 23.9 seconds last year on stage one. Like, you know, I'd say it's hard. I wonder, like, I could see why people get so frustrated about the running out of sight of it. But, you know, it's how do you stay motivated when you're driving as hard as you can and you're just losing that level of time through no real fault of your own? You could even see it, and they did a comparison with the in-cars and the difference in the state of the road for when the next couple of cars came through. Like, Mackinnon is just heaving rocks all the way, like the Yoke is almost like a bulldozer.
It looks rough on the car compared to, like, it's for all the world, it looks like he's doing an Acropolis stage, and when it cuts to Salbrook, it's like he's on a warm day in Wales. It looks that smooth by the time he's got through.
Yeah, it's as I said, it's amazing the sheer quantity of stuff they're moving off the road is crazy. Like, but yeah, so again, Peugeot in trouble pretty much straight away. You could actually hear on the coverage Ariel taking off the line, and you can hear that the clutch is starting to slip. You know, you just know the telltale sign the kind of over-raving compared to what speed the car is actually doing. And I think
you could pinpoint the seconds the clutch's heart breaks.
Yeah. Again, he was frustrated. Like, imagine just trying 5 kilometers into the event after, you know, 3 days of probably a very tough recce, and, you know, and all the preparation that's been done before and testing whatever. Like, but yeah, Peugeot were still showing that the car was very fragile. In this season, they obviously got down for the following year. Like, but extremely frustrating for the drivers, and then Granholm then as well. Like, hard. I don't think it was really his fault. It's just one of those things. He committed to Connor, I think, a third or fourth gear right-hander, and there was just a huge rock in the middle of the road. You know yourself, it can be very hard to avoid these things when you're on the line and the car's already at the limit or whatever. Just ran over it, and I think by the sounds of things, he just hauled the sump straight away, and just obviously that was the end of that. Then lost oil pressure and had to pull up,
and he just gave up in the air at that point, to be honest.
He did. So, like, could you blame him? Like, I mean,
but he said it like they're like, this is the year already. He's like, yeah, pretty much.
This is like, he'd 4 points out of 7 rallies. This is actually the, you know, the 7th rally of the year, midpoint of the season, pretty much. And like, has there ever been a worse championship defense?
Leicester City.
Yeah.
Who's going to keep it rallying? I was going to say McRae 96, but.
Yeah, I think McRae 96 was definitely more.
But he still finished second in the series in 96.
Yeah, but that's because they had the calendar was mental.
Yeah,
he turned it around. But yeah, definitely the first half of the year, Jesus, it was just like, I'd say, thankfully he the championship won in 2000, because I'd say Peugeot would have been, you know, probably asking serious questions of themselves if they hadn't done so well in 2000 and had a year like this where, you know, they saw they had the pace but the car just couldn't get around the stage without some sort of issue. Robin Pear was obviously still going, and he was actually had a decent enough rally, in fairness to him, not without issues as well, but he wasn't really challenging for the win, but still did it obviously an awful lot better than the other guys.
Panizzi was benefiting from road positioning as well on day one. He was setting some very impressive times. Like, he now, for somebody who isn't, and what, you know, he probably would profess himself not to have been a huge fan of gravel, he was giving it a good go in a privateer car. He was fourth quickest on one of the stages there on day one. And I think he ended the day in sixth.
I think he was quicker than that. I think he was second quickest on one stage.
You're right. It was actually
Panizzi. On stage three. Yeah.
It was a strange event for Panizzi to bother entering.
They were trying, like, it was probably part of his contract with Fuji at the time. They were obviously trying to build him up into you know, a more complete guy and give him the bit of experience and the rough runs. Like, if you look at the way they did it in 2000, and they still did it this year as well, they switched Granholm around from scoring manufacturer points just to just driver's points, depending on the event and stuff like that. It wasn't a full works car. It was like a Grifone Evo 1 car or whatever, but you know, they still wanted to get him, build him up. He never did a full season, I said, till he was with Mitsubishi, did he? As in, you know, the whole year through, like, but he was never, you know, at the level of the guys, at the other guys on the gravel and stuff like that. You know, it's been mentioned by a couple of people prior that he had trouble adapting to the kind of slipperier conditions. He was pretty much untouchable in the dry tire, but when it got a bit kind of dirty or whatever, he wasn't as able to cope as well as some other guys. But still, not taken away from this. This is a very, very good drive. Macca Martin as well, sitting quickest time on stage three. So fair play to him.
On that one, Mas, you know, on Mark and Martin, and I don't know if they're with him and Solberg with their quick times in day one. I think they made a point in the commentary about Subaru's tactics to split the forwards with the two lads. And it was actually obviously standard practice, but very good and very kind of good preparation that they knew the lads would have good road order. They knew they could be in a position to split the forwards and get Burns a better position and points overall.
Yeah.
So the lads were delivering straight off the bat. And like for Marco Martin to come in, I mean, how many events have he done in the Subaru at that stage?
He'd been with him since the latter end of 2000. I think he'd done Australia with him in 2000, yeah. He'd done a few bits, but he was still at the kind of the start of his ascent into one of the different line guys, but still a very strong performance.
I think just from the two of them from on day one to go out and kind of straight away start doing the job they're at.
Yeah,
I thought that was brilliant.
McRae took a big gamble there. At the end of the day, he just said, right, I'm going to try and just win this rally from the front. A brave call now with in these conditions with the tactics and stuff that as we said are going on. So he pulled a lot of time out of everyone on the final stage and signs it as well. I think Solberg had issues in the final stage. I'm not sure. He dropped a heap of time anyway. He dropped, I think it was a gearbox issue. Yeah, he dropped a bit over a minute on the last stage. He was actually leading at one point, but dropped a bit on. So basically, what happened at the end of the day was McRae had a 21-second lead over Sainz. Burns was in third, then another 12 seconds behind Sainz, and then you had Martin in fourth, Solberg in fifth, and Panizzi in sixth.
Obviously, Burns was given out about, you know, Ford, well, not given out, but Ford were using splits like pit boards at the side. Did any of you spot a familiar face working for Mitsubishi?
Oh, Nash got on to me about this during the week. Who was it, actually?
Ronan Morgan.
Oh, yeah. Jesus, yeah.
Of Billy Coleman and Mohammed bin Salim fame. He was out doing the split times for Mitsubishi on the last year, as you can see it there in the coverage.
Jesus, that's good now. Very shout out to Roy Nash as well, another friend of ours, another huge rally nerd. We'll probably get him on at some stage. I know he's planning his own podcast series at some point, so we'll be sure to give him a shout out there when he gets up and going. He created a quiz there last week, and the fucking thing, I couldn't even get into it there for half it. I had issues with the OLF, but his fault obviously, but some very, very tough questions. So Nash is a proper nerd. Trust him now to spot.
He would know.
Yeah. No, but fair play to him.
It's interesting pace actually from the Citroen. Radstrom set a fourth fastest time as well.
Yeah, would have had the benefit of road order as well, obviously. But still, you know, just that the thing was able to get around. I know Radstrom went out with electrical issues in the last stage, I think, of day one. But just Bogalski was still, you know, tipping away thereabouts for a car to do its first event on a rally like this and be able to get around at all is an achievement in itself. When you think about it, so it was good. And Bogalski, a guy that as we said, not the most accomplished on gravel. I think he actually ended up in the mines at the end, just out of situation and stuff like that. But no, it was a good showing.
Just as we're talking there, before we get into the day one stuff, because I actually don't think much else happened on day one. François Delacour.
Oh yeah.
He did a Carlos Sainz, right? But I never realised this. A T-shirt got caught in the spokes of his bike and he crashed to the bottom.
Oh man.
my dog ate my homework. Like, you couldn't make that up, could you?
It's such
a delicate thing to happen, isn't it? Just out of pure fucking...
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt he was probably going 100 miles an hour down the cliff face on a little unicycle.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't like your conventional road bike or whatever. Like, it was definitely doing something ridiculous. Like
something delicate.
Yeah, have you been following his Instagram actually lately? He's I can't make head or tail of it. I think he's having some sort of low level national championship around his own land or something like that, with his kids driving various bangers around the place and stuff like that. It just looks like
it looks class.
Looks like great, crack. Like, yeah, he's out barbecuing every night then as well. He's living the dream. But,
Did anybody watch? They were very good in the coverage. They showed a full stage of on board Richard Burns, because the stage was shortened and it could be completed within 2 minutes. So
I saw that. The stage was quite severely shortened. It was only, I think, what was the? It was let me just double check.
3 or 4 kilometers or something.
3.59 kilometers, because the drivers were concerned about a drop. And like, having seen some pictures of classic Acropolis rallies in the past, like some of the stages are quite high. I can draw this thing as kind of
even the section there of Burns onboard after it comes up after the hairpin left, and he's coming up, and it's actually quite smooth, and it's a fairly committed section up to the end.
Yeah.
The drop to the left there, I was actually watching that on board and I was there going, holy shit, because
yeah,
it was only during the week I actually played a stage very similar to that on Dirt 2 with that old Brezza, and I was like, geez, this is great. This is like Richard Burns and Acropolis.
Oh, man. Isn't that two-door WRC in Dirt 2, isn't it just the coolest thing ever? I've been hoping for that in a game, in a proper kind of I was praying as well that they get the sound right. And they did. They pretty much got a bang on.
Fall in love with the legacy. Just doing Sweden or Wales in the legacy, and that's it. I'm happy.
Yeah, bless.
It really kind of hits you in the memory bank with those, because it's like it almost does capture a bit of the essence of when you were maybe 10 or 13 with Colin McRae 1, and that was it. And here it is now as a grown up back. What
Henry Master, it's unbelievable. Joe, I will say that, and this is going back obviously a bit more in time. Colin McRae 2 did Greece. I'm not sure it was Greece and Colin McRae 1.
Was it? It was in both,
yeah. The realism or the graphics or whatever weren't there, but you still got a very authentic feel for what the rally was like in those games, even though
it was rough, like. You feel it on the controller, like.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, in fairness, to do that 20 years ago was a fair achievement. So, I always kind of thought the Colin McRae games gave a better feel for what the rally might have been like in real life than the official games did for a long time. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Just looking at what happened on day two, besides that, as I said, that stage being shortened, it was kind of more the same. McRae did actually really well to hold on to his lead. He'd went into the day with a 20-something second lead and came out of it with just under 10 seconds ahead of Sainz. So the order at the end of the day was McRae again, Sainz, Burns. There'd be no change there. Solberg in fourth, and he'd managed to climb back up. Robin Pair in fifth, and Mackinnon had managed to claw his way back up in the sixth. He'd had a 10-second time penalty. I'm not sure what the circumstances were there.
Because I was actually making this note about the stage times over day two. Like I said, there wasn't a huge amount happened, bar like Burns won one stage, pulled that away down to what was it, 14 seconds? Because obviously, I'm purely talking about the battle with Burns and McRae, because that's what this is all about. I know Sainz was in his usual position of quietly sitting on the podium with no one knowing he's there. But you'd wonder, was McRae right with the strategy on day one? Did he know that, was he that kind of intelligent thinking that there is enough pace and mileage for him to make this time up. Because he made the comment anyway, he was saying that at the end of the day, only he reckoned Burns had lost too much time.
I think it was a brave call, but there's not many drivers who could have backed it up other than McRae, I think. But he obviously had the knowledge that the nature of the stages appeared on day two not to be quite as rough for the sweeping. There was going to be time loss in sweeping, but not to the same extent as what you were seeing with Mackinnon on day one. So it was a brave call, but it was an intelligent call.
That's it. Like, I don't think it was a pure kind of lazy on McRae or typical flat out. I think
no.
Again, we've made this
point. But he still had to have that approach too, though. There was somewhere in the middle on it.
Yeah, so like it's like people would obviously look at the whole McRae image of balls out, flat out, no thinking, if and out, flat out, shit. So, but people often forget how smart he was, how good of a competitor he was. Into putting that strategy, and as Tommy said, he had the ability to go with the flat out speed on day one to back up that plan. You know?
If he does parallels with Schumacher in Formula One around the same time as well, Schumacher was the master of just turning on the crazy speed when he really needed to, as dictated by the tactics. You'd often see
qualifying laps in the race.
Yeah. Basically, like he could reel off a string of 15 laps there that could be within a couple of tenths of each other, and he'd be just pulling seconds out of fellas on the track. Braun or whoever in the team would give him the instruction, you need to make up X amount of time, and he'd just get on with it and do it, and it didn't faze him. McRae had that as well. You never got the impression that McRae was, at his limit for a lot of the time. He was within himself, even though he might have been spectacular and going really quickly. There was still the bit left, and then when he really turned it on, it was just a sight to behold. But he didn't need to hear; he'd figured it out. So again, another example. Just three really rough rallies here in the middle of the season, and he ended up winning the three of them. Spoiler alert. Whoops. Burns. Like, this is again, another aspect. Like, such a silly thing to happen. Burns on the second stage of the day just got caught out on a kind of a 90-degree right, and just got stuck. Stupid thing. But what had happened was on the breaking point, or just before or whatever, they'd had one of the the split boards out. One of the team members with a split board out, and like if you look at where he was and how quick he was going, and how much distance he had to the corner. They say in the coverage that it was nothing to do with the split. He just got, it was, it could have been other factors. It definitely was. Like, there was no way that he didn't break it after the board.
It's nice of him to actually not sit and moan. Like, the lads there going, this fall. Like, Burns is kind of mature enough to go, look, I break late, but everyone knows full well he was looking at the sign and he breaks late. He's not going to go blame the team. Like.
But it was embarrassing for the team as well, because, they'd...
Could you imagine just standing there sweating balls and going, Burns come along, you're holding the sign and you look around your shoulder and you're like...
Yeah, cloud of dust and the car is just stuck. Oh, man, that would just be... I'd just be after disappearing down the hill. I wouldn't want to be seen.
You could actually see, like, still standing there, still with the head turned over shoulder, not moving, going...
Yeah. But he had a fair bit of trouble getting it out, which I reckon had a bit of an effect on the rest of his event as well, as we were to see. He lost about 3 minutes on that stage. Like, he could have got points out of the event. He wasn't a million miles away. He was about 15 seconds behind Mackinnon, maybe half a minute behind, 15 seconds behind Delacour and half a minute behind Mackinnon. He could have conceivably got higher up, and, as we were to see, he could have got a few points out of it, but... the prop shaft gave way in on the start line of one of the following stages, something similar to what had happened to Petro's car in Cyprus, and they obviously had flagged it as a danger point, because as soon as it went, he was on the radio to the team asking should he stop or whatever, and they said yeah, just pull it over, because
they were very quick to say, and even the words they used were nope, stop it,
stop the car. Yeah, I think it was on the second last stage. I'm pretty sure they went. Yeah. But as I said, the prop was running through the tunnel, and running very close to the fuel tank with the temperatures over there. And they'd seen Solberg's car go up in a flash in Cyprus. They just weren't taking the risk. So that was his. That was such a silly way to lose an event.
Like, that actually happening. Was it Philip Morrow years ago in the Group N cars back when Group N was fairly popular with the Evo Challenge and stuff? I remember, was it 06 or 07 or something? Coverage. And Philip Morrow had a brand new car and it's like that now. Prop shot popped out. And they were saying it was so close to the bag tank. It's like the heat of it. Was it the prop or the exhaust? No, sorry, his was the exhaust actually. And it was so close to the bag tank that said you can nearly pierce through the bag tank with the heat. It was just too dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, there are things with rally cars where you like, and again, the more expensive, more advanced ones. Yeah. There are things that you just won't chance. You go through a stage with a broken strut or something, but there's stuff you just like that.
Especially the turbo cars, like, because they're running DGTs and stuff are so high, like they're up 800 or 900 degrees or whatever the case may be. So they obviously just can't take the risk with it. But
That was the 30K and 38 kilometer stage where he got cut out with split time. But apparently he was up on McRae and Science at that stage, like the gap was down to about, I think there were those 15 seconds or less between them.
Is there anywhere we can see that split time, or is there any record of it to see how much he was up on the stage?
If you just pause the footage, maybe you're going to see. Yeah.
But they had apparently, well, we're only going by what commentary and things were saying at the time, but that he was up on them. You know, it was a 38K stage and he had a more favourable row position than the two fours.
And the best thing is that stage was repeated. Was that the last stage as well?
It was going to be the last stage, yes.
Exactly, yeah. It would have been a perfect battle of McRae and Burns. Now, in saying that, as much as I'm a Burns fanatic, it'd be very hard to put money against McRae on the last stage if they did go into it.
Yeah, McRae had enough to do, but going into the last stage, Sainz was only 6 seconds off him, going in and looked to be gearing up for a bit of a scrap. To see after a rally like this, to see two cars 6 seconds between them after this length was pretty cool to see. Sainz just had plugged away, kept his nose clean, hadn't had any major issues throughout the event, kind of just followed in McRae's wheel tracks and happened to be there, but unfortunately his engine went on the last stage and he couldn't even get out of the stage. She was cooked, so that was the end of it. Pity. You could see
we're talking about 2001 now, not 98.
No, see, this is the thing that just shows again the signs. Imagine, like, do you know, those 6 points for signs would have put him in a different position to end of the season.
Big difference. But you know, you can see his face and like your heart does break from, you can see how deflated he is and how tired he is.
They were gutted, they hadn't won a rally in quite a while at this stage as well, so you know, I'd say that kind of frustration was building as well. But a big pity to see him drop out like that.
Big time, yeah.
Like, to be honest, like, Sainz on the second day he'd set two fastest times. You know, he was really going for it then, you know, into day three. Like, he set three fastest times on the final day. The momentum was with him to a degree. You know, he was hunting down McRae. Now, like Will said, though, you know, would you bet against Colin McRae going into the last stage? No, you wouldn't. But still a tight enough gap, you know, between two guys that wouldn't be giving each other much, wouldn't give each other much room, let's say, you know?
No, definitely not. But yeah, so that was that. So McRae was able to cruise home. A third win in a row actually put him into the lead of the championship. So that was, you know, that was a serious turnaround there in three events. To go from zero to lead in the championship, and it just shows how crazy this season was that you could have a run like that and be back up in the contention. You would have said at this point that Burns still wasn't in with as much of a shout. Obviously, he dropped points in this event, Sainz had as well. Sainz could have been leading the championship after this event if he'd even finished. So it was just another one of those things. Mackinnon was still in second. He ended up finishing fourth in the event, obviously helped by the retirements of those above him, but still, you know, was it still able to drag the car up to there. Was probably, you know, it was definitely clear at this stage that the Lancer was suffering in terms of pace. Obviously, the running order wasn't helping him, but even when he was kind of in a more favourable position on the second and third days, he wasn't able to claw back as much time as he probably would have liked. So,
going back, Sorry, you're just going to mention Solberg, eh?
No, go on.
What yeah, I was going to mention that about the finishing of the event. A strange ending to it with Solberg and Robin Perra on the podium.
And Mackin, whatever, yeah, it was going to... Yeah,
whatever about Solberg going second, because look, he was on the pace, but it's still a massive result at that start stage of his career. But Robin Perra in third, holy shit.
Yeah.
A science-like performance from Robin Perra, really. Yeah, just like, kept his nose clean.
How
yeah.
did that character through the event?
Yeah, he was missing. He was missing his rear bumper in the kind of trademark Rovan Pera look. But
all the cool kids did that.
All the cool kids did it.
The Rovan Pera look.
Yeah. I call it active aerodynamics. I'm very good at it.
Because they're worth it. Yeah. Exactly. Was that Solberg's first podium? Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Fair play to him. Yeah. Good to see. He'd had a pretty terrible run at the start of the season, just with, you know,
actually, we never acknowledged his hat.
Oh yeah, good hat.
I think that should have been the sponsor for this week, is Solberg's baby at the beach hat.
I don't know. There was kind of Balearic overtones to those hats, because every time inside in service, it was in the last rally, he was wearing it too, and there was some banging tunes on in the background.
Yeah.
Well, if it was Judge
Jules or, you know, Dave Pierce or something in the service part.
It was very Kevin and Perry, right, wouldn't it, the hat?
If it was Burberry, I'd say something, but I mean, it's bright blue and baby.
Sure, it's the corporate colours, man. Fucking, this is the...
No, I'm not disputing the colours, I'm disputing the hat. It's a
24th century. Got to represent.
It's as bad as Delacour's glass. I'm not Delacour's.
Orioles.
Orioles sunglasses. Could you imagine that hat with the Orioles sunglasses?
Oh, man. They would have had to cancel the rally.
They cancelled the championship.
Yeah. Nothing would have been too much. Delacour was...
Fifth
and Bogalski sixth, so managed to get a point on Desaro's gravel debut. So, good.
Was that the first points? Was that the first driver's points for a Citroen? It must be, because Bogalski dropped to eighth in Spain, so it would be their first official points. Like
for Desaro, WRC will say, is it?
Yeah, well, for Citroen, yeah. Well, yeah, apart from the kit car days, really.
Yeah. I don't think they were registered for points this year. I don't think they were.
No.
One thing we missed there on day one, I want to make a point of, which I think is pretty cool. And again, we mentioned it before about the onboards not being kind of, or being overly edited. Now, Armin Schwartz coming off one of the stages, and you can see him just cruising down past the finish control. And he's on the team radio talking about the issues with the car. And I just think it's cool when you see them. Like, it's just nice to see. You know, we all know when you come off a stage and you're doing that bit of road where you're coming down to where the road is open, and you're sort of kind of hopping around. It's nice to see that bit of behind the scenes, the bit of honesty in it where he's on the radio, the car is having problems. You just don't see it.
When are they going to get to, you know, the level of realism there for rally games and sims where you'd have to do your recce and your road section and the whole
all that misery? I love that.
Yeah, you say that, no, I'd say after one.
I know. I used to remember in Richard Burns' rally, you could, like, every rally you could wreck in stage. Now you're wrecking at rally speed, which probably not too different to what somebody doing real up here. But,
yeah. Driving the wrong way down the stage. Tommy. Yeah.
But look, I
not guilty, Your Honor.
I don't see it, like it. I used to enjoy doing that. Now, what I do like about dirt, again, is having to actually stop the car after the finish line. That's brilliant.
I think that kind of stuff. I'll maybe we'll get.
Even holding it on the handbrake at the start line before you
I got caught by the balls today with that. I paused it. I was doing Rally Germany, and I paused it, and I forgot I paused it. I went back in, forgot I was holding the handbrake, and 10 second penalty.
Idiot.
I'm just looking at the results here, and Colin McRae won the rally and set only 2 fastest stations.
Yeah, he won.
That's a fantastic performance. Like,
and he won by like 49 seconds. Having done so, you know what I mean. It was another case of driving with the head more than the right foot. And he'd won. Was it just fair? He'd won before. He hadn't won a single stage.
That was the first one for the Focus.
So kind of something similar, kind of a team here that. It was just a case of getting around, but as I said,
I think Morris, it's a case of he really knew the event, he knew the stages, he knew what he could do, And that's what he pushed so hard in day one. And he just said, he just made, and again, he was kind of working up the whole image of McRae going, oh, should I just try and win it from the front? But he knew
exactly what he was doing. No, it was a brilliant win again. And as it was to set him on course for, to be in contention for the championship for the rest of the year. So,
but if you have two wins back to back, too, there's a certain, I suppose, what sports psychologists would call it is flow, that you're in a kind of a sense of flow or zone where basically the confidence. Everything's just working right, and like you can obviously operate within yourself to a degree when you are at that level, because you're just success breeds success.
He was lucky as well that the car held on these events. It let him down on the rallies earlier on the season, but did obviously manage to do a bit of work. Even though I think did obviously signs had gone out due to mechanical failure here, but still it was. It was good that the car was able to hold the pace as well. So that was kind of it. The
point about this win put him on tied with Sainz and Kanken for 26 wins.
23 was it? I think it said 20. Yeah, but they were all So if Sainz had won, he would have been the most successful driver in terms of rally wins at the end of this event. But he didn't quite make it. I think it was 20. Yeah, they were tied on 23 or something.
Tied, because him, Sainz and Kanken are 26 at
this point. Shout out to the people there. I'm not even going to try and pronounce the names because I'll just embarrass myself. A couple of guys in OLT, all the Starlets and Corollas, they're bringing up the end of the field. A couple of people in Hyundai accents.
The Micra, 34th.
Out of four. Ahead of a couple of four-wheel drive cars, well, one now, and quite a lot of the Super 1600 cars finished. Actually, in fairness, Loeb actually dominated.
I'm looking at that here. The Toyota Starlet EP81.
Yeah.
Oh God, I'm not pronouncing that name.
Yeah. That's a 91 shape Starlet.
It is the bubble Starlet, as they call it.
A Peugeot 106.
Yeah, and Cleo Williams retired in the final stage. Talk about got it all the way around and then for it to give up in the last stage.
There's a guy who always popped up, you'd always see him on the finishing list. He must have been a national guy over there. His name just came up. The way you see with some of on these European events on the entry lists, instead of a first name and surname, this guy's nickname is all his entries in it. You'd see that on a lot of them. This guy, Leonidas, that was it. That was his name, Leonidas. In McGann Maxi.
Cool. Would you ever think about doing that? Just entering an Irish rally there, or just kind of pseudonym? No.
I'm going to enter my next one when I go back competing with my name online.
Are we not hated enough?
What are you going to call it?
I can go further. I can be hated even more. No problem.
Oh yeah. keep reaching for that rainbow.
I'm world champion. Be hated.
Yeah. So we'll.
Who's your drivers at the rally?
Oh, for me, a Petter Solberg.
Okay.
Are you just picking someone who doesn't win just to be awkward?
Well, no, you can't give someone who wins the drive of the rally because they've obviously had the drive of the rally. They won the rally. So it has to be someone.
I can give McRae my drive of the rally. I don't give a fuck.
Look, I was just going to say that it would be a toss up because of how smartly he did it. But I think for Solberg at that stage, it was a great drive.
I'm torn between McRae and Delacour simply because Delacour, his wrist must have been agony to drive with in those conditions. But
good point.
Because he said, I think five maybe fastest times. He had nearly the most fastest times in the rally,
And even then, he was kind of the second or third quickest in our last stages as well. So yeah, good pace. Good the crazy Frenchman. He was still competitive. Like Sainz, he was still competitive towards the end of his career. So he was definitely in the latter stages of his factory kind of career this stage.
I think Delacour's, we could say this, we know now obviously this was the latter end of his career. I think a lot of people would argue that since the accident with the Ferrari F40 hitting the Citroen road car, that was when his career really went downhill. I think poor decisions post this year really, it fast-tracked it. I still think he had a lot to offer even at this stage.
You did, yeah. I think, yeah, he probably left Peugeot under a bit of a cloud with the whole kind of falling out with Panizzi and stuff like that. And Ford,
I would say that he had more raw pace than Sainz even now at this stage.
He, yeah, it's a fair argument to make. Yeah, again, poor choice. Like, you know, you can say poor choices. He might have had any choice only to go to Mitsubishi to stay in the frame for the following year. And
yeah,
but, yeah. So anyway, yeah, that's kind of it in the manufacturer standings in Ford in the lead overall. So, you know, did turn things around as well. Mitsubishi, then Subaru, Peugeot, languishing in fourth again, just purely because of the car's unreliability. And then Skoda and Hyundai. Skoda, unfortunately, didn't get into the points here either. And an event that might have suited him, Schwartz wasn't too far away in the end. And Thierry was in 10th, but Likes finished in 9th. Just didn't really figure in the whole.
He seemed to be a bit of a disaster already. Everything seemed to go wrong on him, braking and stuff. And yeah, they nearly had to do an engine transplant on the up.
But he had a 2 minutes. 10-second penalty on his time as well.
Yeah,
I think that is related to there was a heavy landing where he blew the intercooler, the rad, he basically anything that could be deemed as plumbing in the front end of the hair was wiped out of it.
Anything that was involved with
a 3-in-1.
Yeah. Anything that was involved in keeping fluids cool and in circulation was damaged. That's not good.
Yeah.
But he would have been seventh. Like without that penalty, he was in seventh by about 8 seconds.
Yeah. Big attrition rate in the rally as well. 47 finishers out of 110 entries. Like, so it just shows how tough it was. As again,
it's gonna be your entry list today.
it's kind of the sad fact.
It's still a bit of love story in Twilight.
Yeah.
It is still nice to see though some of the more I don't want to say fragile cars the more pedestrian kind of cars. The Micra, I think that's fantastic.
But Tommy, they're bulletproof, folks. They're strong cars. It's still a front wheel drive car in a rough event. I wouldn't
enter that. Do you know what? Yeah, if you were thinking about it and you had to, if someone told you, right, you have to get around these roads in the next 3 days, don't worry about the time, just get around the things. It'd be hard to look past an old Corolla, some description, like, wouldn't it? Or
an old XLI Corolla.
With the moss green on the wood flaps in the front.
Yeah. And oh god,
steel rims.
We love Camogie.
A buy and sell up on the dash.
Yeah, we love Camogie. It's St. Cullum sticker on the back window. couldn't kill them fucking things. But anyway, they're definitely the least inspiring car to drive that was ever made. But they're just so dependable. They kind of have their own kind of place.
Speaking of that, going on old shit at Toyota's, remember at one stage, I think, I don't know what age it was, we had like the Jap import version of called the Toyota Sprinter.
Oh, class.
And it was actually a white saloon and it looked like the old Impreza kind of thing. It was a 2 liter. Was it 2 liter diesel or petrol? Or what was it? The thing was an animal. I was at the stage now where I must have been 14 or 15, where I was trying to steal my mother's car and go up the woods up near my old house. Somewhere
the Banshee Woods.
And no, Tommy, an undisclosed location in Tipperary.
Just off the.
I used to go up the road there, with the entrance super in the woods, and I remember I stuck it into a ditch one day and landed in there, and I drove it out. Like, it was a good 3 or 4 feet down, and it drove it.
I love the way you tell me this, and you didn't tell me this the evening that you said, "Oh, can I have a drive your Impreza Turbo?"
Yeah,
and you took me down that direction.
Yeah.
You did.
Oh yeah. Drive that one.
He thought it prudent not to tell you. Maybe you might have tried to pull him out of the driver's seat. But anyway. Yeah, so that pretty much wraps us up for the Acropolis for this week's episode. We're heading to the Safari next for one of the last runnings of that event. So very interesting one, something we'll be covering in depth next week. Apologies, the podcast is actually delayed this week due to some technical difficulties on our side. But hopefully normal service will be resumed next week and we should be able to get a podcast to you. I'm ready for Thursday morning for your commute or your stage sanctioned exercise or whatever the situation is. So from myself, Morris, thanks again for listening to us. Keep liking, subscribing and following us on the various channels, and from me and the guys. Thanks very much, and we will talk to you next week.
Thanks very much, guys. Thanks. Cheers and enjoy.
We might see you next week. I don't know.
Stay safe.